How's it work?
It's still fun, though. It's just it's going to be a different style of writing. So it's really odd to write that way. But it's fun.
Remind me what verse is the heaven things for. I found the one in verse 1. And then let me look up the etymology.
It comes in chapter 2 for us.
Thus the heavens and the earth were completed.
Yeah.
Is that one where you also like separate
the first verse,
verse 15.
And you also want to look at, I think it's 6, where you separate the heavens from earth. So
okay. One
sets
it. Nobody saw that. Okay, so this version has sky instead of heaven, but the Hebrew word is the same word.
Yeah.
So, and then 16, you said?
Yeah.
Wait.
Like right up,
it's
one.
Or
50.
Yeah,
thank you.
I have no idea how
many
people
to be able to
tell.
Like,
where
you look at
the sky, where he creates the heavens and then he separates the heavens and
releases
stars.
Yeah, like this first one, I'll just put it in the
Yeah, so I get, it may be different because one of them is just like giving me the regular like sky. It's just the word in English sky, and then the other is heavens.
All right, good morning everybody. Welcome to our Wednesday class, class number 4. So we've got a lot, as always, to cover. A couple of housekeeping things pretty quickly. So I'm handing out, did I get enough? But you need one more, thanks. I was afraid I'd miscounted. Everybody else have one? Okay, so just look this over. We can talk about it a little bit more on Friday, but these are some of the things I'm going to be looking at in your first paper. But I'd rather hold off. Just look through it. There's nothing. I mean, we use standard grammar at Hillsdale, so there's nothing too unusual, but just look through some of the things that I'm going to be really focusing on there. And again, I'll talk about that more on Friday. So if we have a quiz on Friday, which is a possibility, of course, it's always a possibility, but if we have a quiz, it will be only up through Thucydides. So I am assigning, though, right now I'm assigning Crito to you guys. So I'd like you to read Crito for Friday, but if we have a quiz, you won't be quizzed on it yet. So, but I would like you to start with that. Carly.
What sort of things should we study for the quiz?
Well, the first one's always going to be a little bit tricky, just to kind of see. I haven't even made it yet, and I'm not sure it will be Friday. It'll depend how the spirit, whichever spirit that is, moves me today and tomorrow. So I'm not totally sure, but it won't be, from my perspective, it won't be that obscure. It'll be 5 questions, all multiple choice, and I may have like A through E, so you'll have to think about it. It won't be easy, like you just pick it right out. But it'll be some things either over the readings or what we've talked about, but not over Turabian. So you don't have to study Turabian for this, but just the Heritage Reader and the readings that we've had up through the Thucydides. Okay. So I'm going to go over just a few things, and maybe this will help, Carly, trying to figure out where we are, because we're transitioning now. We're moving pretty quickly from the Hebrews into the Greeks, and because we've got to get into the West. And as we've talked about, the Jews are an Oriental people. They're not an Occidental people. They're not Western. But they obviously end up in the West. And you know, we could ask all kinds of questions. I think important questions like, why were the Jews chosen of all people? There's so many peoples around. You know, why does God choose this group of people? And there's no real answer to that, except they're small. They don't count for a lot. And that seems to be God's MO, that he tends to go for those who are weak, those who are the underdogs. We see that all the time. We'll see that, of course, with Jesus. So it seems to be the way that he works. But regardless, I mean, who knows, right? He chose the Jews, and he may have, you know, being omnipotent, he would have always known he was going to choose the Jews. And yet there's some free will involved in that as well, because God's not beholden to his own will. He's true to it, but he's not beholden to it. So we see all of those things in the way that this story unfolds. But the Greeks are really the first Westerners in the sense of Western civilization. And I'll get to that in just a moment. So just this morning, I tried to write down, actually thinking about Carly's question before I even got here, what would I ask you about? And this, I don't want you to be limited to this, but I've already come up with 11 major themes that we've talked about so far in the first 3 days. So I'm just going to list those, and my guess is they're not going to be that different from what you have, but you may not have delineated them yet. I certainly hadn't before this morning, even though I've taught this for 19 years. I was thinking, and I actually got a new book finally over after 9 years of using the old book. I thought it was probably good to start a new one. So I'm writing in it as we're going along. But just quickly, we have creation, obviously, and you know, I don't want to limit it to this. Just that. Creation involves time. It involves space. Obviously, it involves a lot of things. Sovereignty. Yeah. What? So when I say creation, there's a lot there that we can unpack from that. The Imago Dei. I think I only use this term briefly with you, but this is the idea of Elohim, right? The idea of being made in our image. That is, that humans somehow have a different imprint on them than all the other creatures. And we haven't been able, I mean, in this class, and nor could we haven't really been able to define what that means. All we know is that somehow we're made in the image of God. So we have a likeness to him in some way. Now, does that mean if we saw him before us, he would look like us? Obviously, that's not what happened with Moses, right? And, of course, God doesn't even appear except through the voice of the angel through the burning bush. So there are all these mediaries in between. And we won't see God appearing again until he's a brand new baby, at least from the Christian perspective. So it's going to be a long, long time before we have any real understanding of Imago Dei, and yet it's there. It's right there. We are made in his image. I personally think it has something to do with free will. I think it has to do with how we make choices, but I don't know that. I mean, that's just a guess from like a guy who's 50 and been thinking about this stuff. I'd have nothing, no superpowers other than my brain. No, that's not a superpower. I'm not bragging. Believe me, my brain is really flawed. Never mind. I'm going to stop before I dig myself into a hole. Right? Okay. The third theme would be order. And I think that's tied pretty intimately to creation. But God is not disordered. He's not chaotic. Now, this is going to, we haven't talked about this yet, but this is going to get into huge questions for us about not only the nature of good and evil, but also the nature of truth and beauty and ugliness. So if God is ordered, it's traditionally been argued that in that order, now I realize if you're coming from a Calvinist perspective, you're going to disagree with this to a certain extent, but traditionally this is the way it's been argued, that evil is not an independent reality, it's the absence of good. So there's nothing sovereign in evil. Satan has no sovereignty. Satan exists only by the will of God, only. He's a creature. So we're not, Christians aren't Manichaeans. We don't believe good is equal to evil. We believe good is superior to evil. But how you play that out is going to be a big debate among both Jews and Christians. So what do we mean by that? But traditionally, evil is seen as the absence of good. In other words, remember when God proclaims himself, he gives the title, I am that I am. He's basically saying, I'm perfection. Everything else is imperfect in some way because it's a reflection of me. Therefore, it can't be perfect. You can't have two perfect beings. That's not possible. So you can't have two omnipotent beings. They can't be both omnipotent. Right? So one has to be above the other. So there can only be one God, and Satan is an angel. He is not a God. So that becomes a kind of an idea, and we're going to see that, especially Boethius, Augustine, when we get into the early Middle Ages. It'll be really important. Okay, fourth theme, stewardship. What agency do we have as women and men? What is our stewardship over the earth? What do we do? And in stewardship, we can argue pretty quickly, I think, that there's a huge difference between having responsibility and having control. Right? Control, power, is different from authority and legitimacy. So when the cop upholds the law, he or she's good. When the cop violates the law, there are a few things worse in society. Right? Same thing with a priest. Priest upholds the law, perfect. It's what he's supposed to do. priest violates the law. There are a few things worse than that. So we have the same kind of thing here with agency. Our agency has to be in proportion. That is, we're not gods, and we're not meant to rape the earth. We're meant to cultivate the earth. Right? So there's a duty that goes along with the responsibility of stewardship. Number five, tied to this, the question of naming. Right? Adam is given the power to name all things. And notice, everything has a name until we get to God. God has no name. He has a title. And the reason for that, I think, is pretty obvious. If Adam is given the power to name, he can only name something if that thing is commensurate with the name. So if it is wheat, it will act as wheat. If it is tree, it will act as tree. God can do whatever he wants. So God doesn't have a name. We don't have the ability to name God, but we do have the ability and, in fact, the duty to name other things. Lionel.
Two questions on that. So
sure.
When God said, tell them I am the I am, that yes. is still a title and not a name?
Well, I mean, I guess it's what is it called? I can't remember the actual term. It's called a tetragram. Am I right? To have a title as a name, or it's a tetragonomy, I can't remember. But to have a title as a name, it's not the same thing. In the same way that when we look from a Christian perspective, Christ is not a name, it's a title. He's the Christ. So those kinds of, we don't know God's name. We're never given it.
And then the follow-up question says, if that is the I am, that title, which I believe was Yahweh in the Hebrew, is that the same used in chapter 2 when we have our Lord God in all caps?
It's not exactly the same because we don't see the title Yahweh until we get to it, right? The YHWH. We don't see it till we get to it. So it's a new Hebrew word at the point that it appears. But again, it is a title. So remember, and I don't know if any of you have grown up in a Jewish household, you can never write G-O-D. You cannot write it. Right? It's you just can't. It is one of the greatest sins to be committed in a Jewish household. You write G-D because you're not allowed to speak the name or write the name of God in that way. And that's part of the reason that where the males, where the yarmulke and so forth, because of the way God views you. But it's a really important thing that for the Jews especially, it is nameless. It is above. There's a name, but it's above our ability to know. So, and we shouldn't search for it either. That would be Gnosticism, to try and get a mystery to it. So, Carly, you had your hand up next.
Yeah, what about Jesus? How is that not a name for God?
Totally different, because Jesus now is the second person of the Trinity, has revealed himself through the incarnation. So in the same way you couldn't have false images of God, you couldn't bear images of God prior to Jesus, now you can. By the incarnation, it changes everything. Jesus is the image of God, so he must have a name. But we'll get into that, because that's really important. Jesus is a really funny name, actually. It's Greek. It's not Hebrew. If it were Hebrew, it'd be Yeshua, Joshua. It's a Greek name. It's meant to be kind of a playful name, like we might call Billy instead of William. It's a playful name, and that's fascinating in of itself. It's a very intimate, casual name. So we'll get to that. Obviously now Jesus is an extremely high name, but it wasn't meant to be, at least in the way Mary named him. So in the way he's remembered. Yeah. Bryson.
I might be overcomplicating this naming thing. Back to that statement about Adam naming everything, because if I recall, he named all the creeping things on this earth.
Right.
Along those lines. However, like even in today, when we find new insects or new creatures or things like that, I'd say we name them.
Yeah. But Adam, man.
What's that?
Adam just means first man. I don't mean literally Adam. Oh. I mean men have the right to name. Men and women. Sorry. I'm not a literalist. I didn't mean it that way. So Adam is shorthand for all men. Adam doesn't actually name everything.
I didn't know that.
But he's given the power. Yeah, Adam means first man. So it's also kind of a title more than a name, even though it's become a name now. Eve means first woman, right? It's not a... So we don't actually... I mean, we call them Adam and Eve, but they could have been Billy and Martha. So, yes, Shelby,
yes.
Right? Thanks.
So when you say that we have, like, the power to name things, and that means that, like, a tree can only be a tree, does that mean that we are defining what a tree is, or is like that defined by God and we're just putting a word to it?
Yes. The argument is, and you can disagree with this, and we'll get into this when we get into the medieval period, especially because there's a whole debate about what's called nominalism, and it gets back to Bryson's question as well as yours, that asks, do we have the ability to change the name of something? And if we do, does it change the thing? But the traditional argument, again, we live in a very subjective time period. So most of us don't like authority. We don't like subjectivism, or we don't like objectivity. We like to be subjective and choose our own things. This is not that world for the Jews. The world for the Jews is very objective, and the Greeks too. So you wouldn't name a tree Petey, because the tree is a tree, and so there is a thing that goes with it that also defines it. So the thing in and of itself is the name, and the name is the thing. But it is only a tree is only a tree because it lives out tree-ness. I mean, we're getting into really serious philosophy that I don't want us to get into too much now. But it does. The question is excellent, Shelby, because it all goes back to this: what do we name a thing?
So is it more that we have the power of language? Like, is that more what it's getting after?
Yes, we have the power of language, but language has a power too. Yeah. Words matter. They really matter. So let's just say for the rest of the semester, I decided to call you Betty. Well, that's not who you are, right? And there's something odd about that. So, I mean, nicknames are fun, obviously, but that's not quite what we're doing. So we have to be careful. So if I tell you, well, good is evil and evil is good, I'm lying. Right? And there is an objective understanding of good, and there's an objective understanding of evil, even though there are a billion ways we could argue about it. But we can agree that there's, and we'll get to this especially with the Greeks, but don't ever think the Jews are sitting around. They will debate what is the meaning of justice. They never debate whether there is justice or not. There is absolutely justice. God is justice. But how do we know it? Well, you're Shelby and I'm Brad. Of course we're going to see it differently. God made us differently, even though we're made in his image. So we have to have individuality too. We're not conformists. And yet we need some kind of commonality. Is that,
yes.
Does that help? Okay, good. Yes, Soren.
Just quick comment on that. Doesn't that actually go back to what we talked about at the beginning, that first theme of God's sovereignty? Instead of, like, God has given us potentially the power to name things, mm-hmm. but our naming is really just a passing down of his power. He's defined it, and it's now just under
us. That's a hard one, because how much will do we have, right? I mean, if we're just doing what God tells us to do, then he could have done it already.
Right, I don't think
so. The agency has to be there in some way.
I think it's more of a seeking out what is the true essence.
It's
like Aristotelian, really. What is the true essence of this particular object?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, but we haven't gotten to Aristotle yet, obviously. And the Jews don't have Aristotle, so. But they're hitting that same kind of point at the same time. So, yeah. Okay, good. So let me go to the sixth theme. Right, and that would be something we hardly talked about, but I want you to at least note it. And that is the rest. That it, taking a rest, R-E-S-T, leisure in the proper sense. The seventh day, it is sacred in some way. It is hallowed in a way that the other days are not. And we haven't talked about this, but remember, in the Ten Commandments too, there are only two commandments to do things. All the other commandments are prohibitions on doing things. And one of them is, thou shalt keep the Sabbath holy. Right? That's so it's not a restriction. It's do this. And so we see it here. Seventh day is holy. God hallows it in some way, a day of rest. And then we see it in the Ten Commandments as well. But this gets back, and I think, to Shelby's point a little bit earlier. This is our modern world. I think probably very few of us in this room would really hesitate to run to Kroger and get milk if we really needed to on a Sunday morning, and then we'd kind of excuse it later. I'm not saying everybody. I know there are people in town who would take it very, very, very seriously. But it's one of those things of the Ten Commandments and of creation we don't really give a lot of thought to. And yet what we're doing here is exactly, you have 4 years of a Sunday. It may not seem like that, because of the way you're working, but this is leisure. Leisure doesn't necessarily mean you're not working. It means that you're contemplating the highest things. So God is contemplating the good on that Sunday. He's satisfied. He's an artisan who can look back and say, the 6 days were good. So we have to have that rest. And, you know, imagine in the whole history of the world, how many societies can provide for the 17 of you in this room to be able to have 4 years out of the economy. And I know you're still doing things, don't get me wrong. But here you are, and you're in between your childhood and your adulthood, though you're adults. But it's that in-between stage, and you get to spend those 4 years doing this. It's incredible to think about that, that we have enough wealth to allow you to do that. But this is 1 4-year Sunday for all of you, because that's leisure, schola, contemplation. That's all a part of this. So we didn't spend much time on it, but I would ask you to think about it as we go along. It's a deeply personal thing, but it's still important, I think, in all kinds of ways. But maybe not publicly important as it is privately important. Bryson.
Sorry, correct me if I'm wrong. I thought Sabbath day was Saturday, not Sunday.
It's debatable. It's the first day of the week. It depends how you define the week. It's totally debatable.
Okay.
So a Jew would say it's Saturday. It starts sundown on Friday night, and it ends sundown on Saturday night.
And if you are...
Remember, time... Our modern notions of time do not apply here.
Totally fine. So, like, for the commandments, then, if the commandments say that you have to observe the Sabbath day, and the Sabbath day is one specific day, either Sundays or Saturdays, is that to say that anyone who's on the wrong day is not observing the commandments? Like, there's, like... Is that, like, a thing? Like...
I'm not God, but that seems like it seems pretty accidental. I mean, I think the day you choose is the day you choose. So, yeah, the culture of the Jews says it's Saturday. The culture of Christians says it's Sunday. I don't know. I'm not going to. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me it means the first day of the week. Okay. So whatever you call your first day, that's the day. It's not the last day of the week. It's the first day of the week. So, however you define it. So, Kenna.
How did that split originate? How come it's Sunday for some and Saturday for others?
Well, okay. This is so hard, guys. There's no modern calendar until the Middle Ages. Right? There's no calendar in the Western world that is any way accurate. There are broad calendars, but everything's done by seasons. So, everything's liturgical, it's seasonal. So, we can't say in the way that I can look at my iWatch right now and say it's exactly 10:21. That didn't exist. So, don't try and impose our modern understanding of time on them. That would be my, I think, that we have to be very careful about. That's why it's a debatable issue. Bryson, class, please. Okay. All right. Anybody else on this? Okay. So, next theme, the idea of fall. And this is, we have sin. And Adam and Eve obviously are kicked out of paradise. And by doing that, by being kicked out of paradise, this changes the whole equation. They have to rethink, what is that relationship between God and his people? So the fall inaugurates all kinds of things. So what do we see after that? We get four themes after the fall and what we had from Judaism. We have the idea of covenant, which we didn't really have prior to the fall. I mean, we could talk about the agreement that God had. I mean, he gave a rule, don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's not the same thing as a covenant. And so we have the covenant arise, and then we have the follow-up to the covenant, the law. So the law is there. And again, I don't mean to suggest there weren't laws or norms prior to the fall, but now that we have them, they're explicit. And those laws in different ways. So it was explicit not to eat of the tree of not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But we still, it's there, right? And these are laws now that we're seeing multiplying, and they're explicit in the way they control our behavior. Yes, what's your name?
Emma,
thank you.
Sure. Our covenant and law, two more of the themes are just underneath.
Yes, so covenant and then law are the two next themes. And then we have two last ones.
Just for noteworthy.
Yeah, no, thanks, yeah. Emma. I appreciate that. So number 10 would be blessings and curses that we see in Deuteronomy. And then number 11 would be the theme of kingship, as we talked about. So those are the themes that I want you to focus on, to think about. What do those mean? And those are things that I think as you're looking back, as you're studying, getting ready for the midterm, still a ways away, but as you're thinking about what's important about the Jews, those aren't all, but those are the, I think, of the things that we've seen, those help define the broader categories of things we need. Carly, please.
What do you mean by blessings and curses?
So that's what we had in Deuteronomy. Remember, if you follow God's law, you will be blessed. If you ignore God's law, you will be cursed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The King James says you'll get the botch and all kinds of things. I don't know what the botch is, but I always love it. Right? It's a great. No, it doesn't sound good. Right? That's like when you meet somebody named Gothmog. You just know that's not a good guy. All right, so the botch is not good. All right, so I'm going to switch to the Greeks unless there are any other questions about the Hebrews. And please know, I apologize if I can't, like the things Kenna is asking, I'm just not a scholar on this stuff. And I know time has changed, but I don't know exactly when. But we can talk about some of the things about when calendars come in years. Yeah, we didn't have years. Yeah, the Jews have a totally different calendar than Christians do. So I forget what year it is for the Jews right now. It's like 5,000 and something. So, okay, anybody else? Anything at all on this? Okay, so we're going to make a big transition then. And now we're going to look at the very first Western people. And we're going to see the opening of the West. And I mentioned this on the first day, but I'm going to stress this again. I wish we didn't live in a day and age where this has to be stressed, but it kind of does. Don't ever confuse Western with white or European. And it's not the same thing at all. So anybody can be Western. There's no category of race or ethnicity that's defined by it. It's something that transcends that. So when we talk about the idea, and it's going to really start about, it's a little earlier than this, but if we need a date, 479 BC is probably the best date in order to kind of say, this is where we start seeing an argument for what is the West. So the way it's defined, and it comes out of the Battle of Thermopylae, but the way it's defined is this idea that the Occident, or the West, is somehow freer than the East. And I'll try and explain what they mean by this. Do not impose our modern notion of freedom. Freedom in the ancient world absolutely did not mean that you can do whatever you want as long as you don't harm another person. That's a very modern notion of freedom. That's a post, really lock-in notion of freedom. So it does not exist in the ancient world. In the ancient world, freedom or liberty was defined by the ability to govern oneself and one's community. So that means if we chose a monarchy, it's free. If we choose a dictatorship, we still choose it. There's a freedom in that. If we choose a republic, there's a freedom in that. So this idea of freedom is about how do you govern yourself. And always, we'll get into this when we look at Plato, but always, the idea of what is politically true is also a reflection of what is internally true. So how would you regulate if we have a republic and the republic is based on three branches? The same thing is true in the soul. The same thing is true in the human person. There's a tension between three parts. We're going to get into that quite a bit. But always, whatever is political is also internal. So order is about the order of the soul as well as the order of the commonwealth. Lionel.
This idea that the West is more free, but freedom is the ability to govern, I don't see how that's very different from the Orient. How did that change from the, say, the Chinese dynasties?
Oh, yeah. When I say Orient, I mean Persia. That's what Orient meant. So China, they didn't even know of China. Persia is what they meant. So in the Orient is anything where modern-day Turkey is all the way to the east. The line of the Orient starts right there on the Ionian coast of Turkey. That's the West, east and west. So in the Orient, the idea was that all, and we didn't read Hammurabi, this is where I probably should have had you read Hammurabi, but in the Orient, the idea, and you could have good rulers. Cyrus is a decent ruler when it comes to ruling, especially in the arts and so forth, education. But in the Orient, you have what is called a god-king. That is, there is no separation between the divine and the human ruler. That's what they mean by not having the ability to govern oneself. So the king is free, but everybody else is his subject. They're essentially his slaves. And he can do with them as he will. So remember what we saw when Samuel's negotiating with God. And God says, look, you have this, you're going to turn into, and that's exactly this kind of thing. How are you going to separate this? How are you going to make sure that your king doesn't become God? That you don't start thinking about politics nonstop when you should be thinking about religion and culture and arts? How are you going to distinguish those kinds of things? So in the West, this idea slowly evolves, and the very first person to really define it is Herodotus. This idea of a West. What is the West? What is freedom? But again, don't put our modern kind of libertarian notions on the past. It just won't work. So we'll see, and I hope you guys had a chance to read. I know at least a few of you did. Shelby, I think you brought this up, have had a chance to read the Melian dialogue among the Persians. But remember, Otanes is really the only one who's truly free. When he says, look, I'm taking my family out of here. He's the first anarchist. I'm out of here. You guys do whatever you want. You can govern yourselves. You can exercise control over each other. I'm out. It's enough. Right, he's gone. So he's the Henry David Thoreau of his age. But it's rare. It's so rare. And that's the distinction. So when we look at a place like Sparta, and Sparta, one of the great Greek city-states, 20% of the population controls everybody else. 20% controls it all. There are two kings. It's a dual monarchy. You have a peace king and a war king. Men and women are separated at birth. Babies that look deformed are killed instantly because there's no way a society would raise them, because you only want, yeah, they wouldn't have used genetics, obviously, but you only want to produce supermen, superwomen. So it's not what we would call free by our modern standards. It's eugenics. It looks like a Nazi society. But they would have seen it as free, because Leonidas is not a god, and therefore they're free. So remember, even in the Old Testament, David, this is so important, and we didn't talk about this, but now we can look at it. The law in Judaism comes before kingship. In other words, the king is just as beholden to the law as everybody else. He's not a god king. David has the Spirit of God upon him, but he is not a God king. God is king. David is a human king. He's not a God king. So that's where, when we start thinking about, are the Jews Oriental or are they Occidental, it gets too confusing, really. I mean, they're both, and it's a both and rather than an either or. But the Greeks will be the first to kind of define what this means. So they want to be able to define who and what they are. Yeah. Lionel, you look like you've got a question.
It's just that it seems like in Rome they started to kind of lose this idea, thinking of Herod declaring himself God and getting killed by worms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's the story in many ways. Every story we see will be the story of the fall. Every one of them. We have something good, it goes bad. It's not always an uplifting course. But you're absolutely right, Lionel. Okay, so let us think about this for a moment. And I'll probably get into this a little bit more on Friday. But when we start thinking about the Greeks, and we're going to look at Greece classically, that is, and there are all kinds of, we're not going to look at ancient Greece, we're looking at classical Greece, we're not looking at, basically, we're going to start about 510, that's about as early as we're going to go, but Greece goes back much, 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 much farther, and especially in the Mycenaean period and so forth. So we're only going to start roughly about 510, but classical Greece, as we know it, is over by 404 BC, so there to Lionel's question. It barely lasts a century. That's actually a pretty good run for humanity, frankly. And I'm sorry that's the case, but it is. That they were able to make it work for about 100 years is really good. But it's going to all fall apart. By 404, it's gone. 5 years later, they execute their best man. They kill Socrates. And it's over then. There's just, the Greeks have not recovered to this day, frankly. And we can look at that, but look at the chaos Greece is in. So there are a lot of modern things, but they really have not recovered. They've been trying for so long, but it's kind of over for them. So we have 510 to 404 BC. In that, when we look at Greece, Greece is never, and here again we have to be very careful, going back to Kenna's point on time, we have to do the same thing with nations. There are no nations that, like we think of in the ancient world. Even when the Hebrews divide into nations, they're tribes. They're not nations in the modern sense. So never think of the Greeks as a nation. They're not a nation. They are 150 city-states that all have the same language and culture, but not the same religion. They all have different gods, though they recognize each other's gods. They all have the same language. They all have basically the same culture, but they all have radically different politics. So Athens, for a time, is democratic. For a time, a really, really, really brief time, it's democratic. Corinth, if you want to we think about the diversity here, Corinth, one of the greatest of the Greek city-states, Corinth was essentially the Las Vegas of its day. This is also why when Paul goes to Corinth, it's a wild town. Corinth, it's a naval town. It's a kind of a free trade, libertarian zone. Kind of anything goes in Corinth. Prostitution, smuggling, trade, anything. Right? Everything's pretty legal in Corinth. So they're as much a Greek city-state as Athens is. Athens, which is really very upstanding and righteous in terms of its morality, at least for a period. So Sparta is a dual monarchy. So everything is based on what we call, and they wouldn't have called it this, they called it the polis. We could translate that kind of into a city-state. But do not think of Greece as a nation. It doesn't exist. In fact, there are no nations until about 1444 in the modern world. So the nation as we think of it, there are empires, there are dynasties, but there are no nations in the way that we think of a single people centralized. But the Greeks come pretty close to being one people, but they do so as what they defined as being a member of Hellas. They see themselves as being Greek, and that's it. That's all that really holds them together. And there are other things that we could talk about, their culture. We could look at the kind of way that they greet one another. We will talk a little bit about that when we get into Plato. But just to give you a sense of this, any of you who've been to the Mediterranean at all, doesn't matter if you're in Morocco or Italy or Greece or in the Balkans, basically when you go into somebody's home, you're greeted. And if you're in Morocco, they give you bread and olive oil. If you're in Italy, they give you bread, olive oil, and wine. Obviously, the Muslims can't drink, but the Catholics, they never stop. So you've got those distinctions. But that was part of it. And you have to think about why that's important. You know, think about what it means when you go into somebody's house and that greeting you give. One of the most important commandments of the God, whether we call him Zeus or whatever we want to name him, one of the most important commandments was God was the God of strangers. He was the God of travelers. So if you went into somebody's home and you were mistreated, you were violating the number one commandment of the God. And that's true throughout all of the Mediterranean. And think about things like, and we'll talk more about this on Friday, but think about olive oil. Yeah, I love olive oil. But of all the oils, it's the fattest by far. Wine, red wine. Yeah, red wine. I mean, don't ever drink it to excess, but a good red wine is good. Paul even tells us to drink some for our stomach, right? So there's nothing wrong with drinking red wine. Jesus' first miracle is changing water into wine. Wine was very important as well. Think about those two things. Yet we all live in an age where we don't want caloric intake. Think if we're on a diet, we do 1,000 calories a day. Right? If you're in the Mediterranean, you eat whatever you can. And if you are given olive oil, that is a blessing upon you because olive oil is the fattiest. It's what you want. Yeah, what a great thing to give somebody. Wine. Anybody know what's great about red wine? Don't forget the effects of it. What does it do in terms of, Lionel?
It's one, it's clean. You don't have to worry about wine being...
Water will go bad.
Yeah.
Wine is already bad. I mean, that's what it is. Wine is grape juice gone bad. Yeah.
So it's clean, and it actually cleans you.
Yes. And we now know, and of course they knew it, but they didn't explain it this way. It's anti-carcinogenic. Red wine, it extends life. Red wine is very healthy for longevity, extremely healthy. And it's got vitamins, tons of vitamins in it. It's grapes. Right? But Yeah, and I know none of you, you'd have to be a sibling for this to make sense. Leo, sorry, I pick on you all the time just because I've known you since you were tiny. But, I mean, think about if you leave a sippy cup of grape juice out on the counter, what's it like the next day?
No longer there.
Yeah, it's wine, right? It's already fermenting. You can keep apple juice out a little bit longer. Orange juice, you can't. It just goes bad. But grape juice, it starts fermenting right away. And it does taste bad, right? You don't want to use Welch's for your wine. You know, it's just, but that's, it's odd. I mean, the moment you put grape juice out, it's going bad. But that's, in that sense, it's preserving it. That's the amazing thing. So these were great symbols to be able to give to one another. So again, we can't put our modern teetotalism or that on the past. These people drank, and it was festive. It's what they did, and it was very important to share those kinds of things. Yeah, Carly.
Could you explain that term halas a little bit more?
Oh, sure. That just means Greece, oh. Right? Halas is essentially, and it can also be spelled H-E-L-L-E-S, but halas just means we belong to the culture of people who identify as Greek. That's it. That's all it means. So, and then we're going to, but you do have to know it because we're going to get into a new time period soon, but not yet, called Hellenistic. And that's basically like Greek light. It's not quite Greek. It's Greek that's been dissolved. But now we're at Greek. Right? But it doesn't last long, that Greekness. Hellas just means I belong to the cultural and language group that speaks Greek. Right? That's what Hellas is. So, yes.
I miss the connection. I don't think that you're proposing that we go out and buy a bottle of wine.
No, I'm not.
I miss the connection, though, between Hellas and olive oil and wine.
Yeah. So, all throughout the Mediterranean, the main products of the Mediterranean are always, the entire economy is based on olive oil, wine, and bread. And it's one reason, and I don't want to take this too far, but you know, you can imagine this whole area of the Mediterranean, you can have caloric intake all the time. Let's say you're living up in Scandinavia. You've got 3 months of the year, maybe, where you can grow things. So it's no, please don't, I've had students write this down before incorrectly, and I've probably said it incorrectly, but imagine a reformation taking place when those who are attempting to rebel or reform the Southern Church have no way to feed themselves. I mean, is it really accidental that Martin Luther arises when the Scandinavians and Germans can feed themselves because they've encountered the New World and they've found potatoes? And potatoes can grow anywhere. Throw a potato down, it grows. And they've never been able to feed themselves. Suddenly, Northern Europe in caloric intake is equal to Southern Europe, and it never had been before. Sure. So that's going to matter a lot. So this is why we see civilization developing in the Mediterranean, in large part because they can feed themselves all the time. And to give those kinds of things, like, Soren, you come to my house, you know, I immediately offer you, doesn't matter if it's Italy or Morocco, I give you olive oil and bread when you come into my house, no matter how strange you are to me, because that's what the God decrees. So what I want to get at is there's an element of greeting, there's an element of friendship that goes with the divine, but it's also based on what they can grow and what is important to them.
And you're saying that that's kind of a unifying part of Hellas.
It's also a unifying part of Hellas. It's also what makes the Greeks like every other Mediterranean people too. So it's something that unifies them as a people. And the Greeks they're incredibly influential in all of this. Okay. Yeah, that's the Melian dialogue, we'll get to it. But yeah, so that's why I wanted to bring that up.
Okay.
But yeah, I can see why it might seem a little distant. But the reason is simply because that's their economy. That's how they give thanks. So yeah, not to get too much into Christianity yet, but there is a reason, and I'm not saying it's not God's will, it is, but there is a reason Jesus' first miracle is to turn water into wine. It was the greatest symbol of friendship in the Mediterranean. He doesn't cure a leper. He doesn't raise somebody from the dead. He's at a party. That's really vital to understand his whole mission, the whole idea of Hellas and what's going on there, and the fact Jesus' name is Greek.
Okay, I think.
So we'll get into all that.
Yeah, it's a little cloudy, but.
Okay, so just think about in terms of friendship and what it means to bond and to allow peoples to talk to one another. Okay, breaking of bread with olive oil is the way that you initiate friendship.
So it's the idea that although there are 150 city-states,
yes,
that this civilization has figured out how to interact in such a way...
with itself,
right,
and with others.
Okay.
Yes.
Now I see.
Yeah. Not conquering, though they do that. The right. Corinthians conquer. But yeah, not in that same way that we see with the Persians.
Okay.
Right? So that... And I do want to read one thing here, but Kenna.
I had kind of like two things. So then the main point of that was when you're able to sustain yourself, you can reform yourself, and that's like...
Not always. Right? It's not... I don't want to suggest that simply because you're materially well off, you're going to be moral. That's
but
not...
you have the ability to begin to reform yourself. So like when
as
you
a civilization, like, generally. Okay. But we also know that when civilizations get too wealthy, they also become extremely corrupt and decadent. That's also a norm.
The other kind of question that I had was, is that the reason why in so many of those like Greek myths, it's always like Zeus the traveler?
Yes, always. Yes, absolutely. And we'll see it in Northern myth too. Odin is, you know, he's a wanderer, he's a traveler. Okay. And partly because, and Odysseus, obviously, right? That's all very important for understanding that movement and thinking about the cultural significance of it. So
this is maybe deviating like way, way out of the way.
It's okay.
But how come when it used to be like we were based on this idea of like the Greeks and the West being like the chief god was a wanderer, who was a traveler, who was exploring.
He was at least the patron of wanderers. Yeah.
Yeah. And then now in the modern day, wanderers are kind of like looked down upon.
Gypsies,
like,
yeah, right.
Yeah, gypsies, people who are going around and going on adventures instead of, you know, settling down, getting a good job, raising a family.
Right.
What kind of like paradigm shift occurred in order to have that happen?
Yeah, let's. I'm going to hold off on that because that's something we will definitely talk about throughout the course. So, Lionel, last question, then I want to finish this up today.
Sorry.
Are you? Oh no, please go ahead.
No, you answered it.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so let me. I want to end with this because we've only got 5 minutes left. I want to try and throw the gauntlet down here and figure out what's different, what happens. So, around 500 BC. So we'll get into philosophy later. What I want to talk about now is patriotism, basically Western ideals defined. So around 500 BC, there was a real movement among the Greeks to start resisting the Orient, in particular Persia. Persia was a huge empire. It was very wealthy, also extremely decadent, very wealthy. And the people there, the ruler, was the god king. Everybody else was his slave. And in 499 BC, the Greeks convinced some of their fellow Greeks, that is, the Greeks as a whole, convinced the Greeks who were on the Persian border, but had been somewhat, they were being ruled by Persia, but kind of off and on. It was a pretty fluid situation. But they encouraged those Greeks to rebel. So the Greeks that were living on what's now the extreme western coast of Turkey, right there, they had those Greeks rebel. And this is an excuse the Persians can use then to crush the Greeks. So the Persians launch 4 separate major invasions. So remember, the Greeks are these tiny little city-states. The cities maybe had 300 people. Sometimes they had 10,000. But they're not a lot. These are small population, 150 different ones. So the Persians launch 3 invasions. These are called the Persian Wars. The Persians, who are a centralized empire with battle-hardened men, they send these guys 3 times in 494, in 490, and then again in 480 to 479 to take out the Greeks. And the idea, and the two great leaders are Xerxes and Darius of the Persians, the idea is the Greeks need to be taught a lesson. Essentially, before we let this crazy notion, and I'm not exaggerating it, this is not hyperbole. The Persians are thinking, before we let this crazy idea of freedom getting out, we're going to crush it. It's like a disease. So we're going to kill it. And we're going to make these guys worship a god king. It's enough. Enough is enough. And so they launch these invasions. Part of it's just pride. Persia wants to crush Greece, wants to crush Hellas and take it out. And the Greeks, unbelievably, against every odd possibly imaginable, keep holding off the Persians. It's stunning. And in the last moment, here in 480, in the last major invasion, Xerxes is so furious at the Greeks that he sends not only his fleet, but he sends 100,000 men to march. So they have to march all across the Aegean coast and down into Greece. It's not going to be easy, but he's got 100,000 men that are going to march and do this. And one of the Persian kings, the war king, Leonidas, has had a vision. He's talked to the oracle, and the oracle tells him, the oracle's the priest between God and the gods and man. And the oracle says to him, you will either go down in infamy or you will go down in fame, one or the other. Right? It's, you will not have an easy death. It will be a death that's either ignominious or it will be glorious. And so Leonidas takes 300 of his men, and they go to this little place north of Hellas on the Aegean coast called the Gates of the Lion, or the Gates of Fire, or in the Greek, Thermopylae. And the 300 under Leonidas stand in this tiny, narrow place in the mountains where they actually hold off the 100,000 Persians for days. So 300 against 100,000. And they're able to hold this off. And I'm going to read. This is Herodotus. I love this. Xerxes let 4 days of battle go by. He kept expecting the Greeks to run away, but when on the fifth day they had not gone away, but were instead holding their position, remember, 100,000 against 300. They're holding their position in what seemed to him a display of reckless impudence. He lost his temper, and he sent his most trained forces, his special forces, against the Greeks. His special forces charged into the Spartans, and they only fell in great numbers. Then, although others rushed in to replace them, even they could not drive the Spartans away, though they too suffered great losses in the attempt. Indeed, now here's the critical line. This is the beginning of the West, right here. The West is birthed at this moment. The Greeks made it clear to everyone, but especially to the God King, that although the God King had many combatants, he had no men. It's just incredible. I mean, this is the point. Now, every one of those 300 is killed. They're killed. They're wiped out. But you can imagine what that does for the Greeks. Here are the Spartans, who are the weirdos of Hellas, who gave their lives for everybody else. And of course, they're doing it for glory, too. But they give their lives. That's the moment of the birth of the West. The West is born the moment the last Spartan dies, right there. So last thing, I'm taking you guys over a few seconds, but last thing, I want you to know this from Hillsdale Heritage. This is very important. That Civil War soldier out there, I don't know if you guys know this, but on the first day of Gettysburg, guys from Hillsdale, inspired by Leonidas, set themselves up in a bottleneck on the road into that little Lutheran town, and they held off the Confederates 10 to 1. 10 Confederates to every one Yankee. And the Yankees held it off enough that the Confederates were so fearful, they refused to enter the town that day. And of course, the rest of Gettysburg is Lee trying to take the town and the Heights, and he can't do it. Every one of those Hillsdale men gave their lives in the name of Leonidas. That's cool. Okay, thanks, guys. I'll see you on Friday, all right? Make sure you've done your readings. So I did assign Crito, but you won't be quizzed on it if we have a quiz, all right? That's the only thing I'm assigning, yeah, just Crito. But you won't be quizzed on it if you have a quiz, all right?
I'm glad you're here. Dr. Brewster, I have a couple of things for you.
Sure. Yeah, and Soren, I didn't bring my laptop, and maybe Friday next week, if we have a moment, you could show me.
I have nothing outdoors.